With Senator Kamala Harris dropping out of the presidential race, the once racially diverse field of candidates is looking very white.
It's pushing to make sure that we are covering candidates of color as much as we can, just in terms of giving them the same kind of attention that other candidates are getting.
Today in the Takeaway for December 5th, we'll take a look at how the media has helped shape which candidates made it this far and who's had to call it quits. Also on the podcast, nearly 10% of people in Mississippi have been stripped of their right to vote. A new federal lawsuit looks to challenge the state's practice of permanently disenfranchising felons.
Having these draconian disenfranchisement laws that are rooted in post-Civil War Mississippi, these schemes violate equal protection clause. They disqualify black voters at a rate of 2-1 in Mississippi.
A new federal lawsuit looks to challenge the state's practice of permanently disenfranchising felons. Plus, President Trump is tightening access to food stamps and 700,000 people are set to lose benefits. You have thoughts on it.
I wonder sometimes if the system is being abused.
877-8-MY-TAKE is the number. Let's get started with that story. On Wednesday, the Trump administration finalized a new rule that would eliminate food stamp benefits for nearly 700,000 Americans. Over the past several years, congressional Republicans have sought to increase restrictions to the federal food stamp program known as SNAP. And we heard from you about your reaction to the new rule.
I think we should increase the tax on the top 1%. Instead of making the needy suffer. I also used to be a food stamp caseworker, so I've been on both sides of the desk.
I have never relied on food stamps. I think that it's okay for the government to help out a little bit for people that really need it. However, I wonder sometimes if the system is being abused to some degree.
Of course, the cuts to food stamps could never replace the tax cuts he gave to the top 1% and continued lack of income taxes paid by Amazon, Google, etc. When did poverty become so offensive?
Poverty is expensive. The president boasting the greatest economy ever and then cutting food stamps, it likens itself to reinforcing the front lines in the war on poverty.
About 40 million Americans are estimated to have relied on food stamps in 2018. And with similar cuts in the pipeline, millions of more are likely to lose benefits by the end of President Trump's first term. For more on this, I'm joined by Claire Brown, a staff writer for the New Food Economy. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Claire.
Thanks so much for having me.
So who's going to be affected by the most recent rule change if these go into effect?
This rule change applies to so-called able-bodied adults without dependents. So this is a group of people that the government has decided could have a job and for whatever reason doesn't. They will now be required to work or prove they're looking for work for 20 hours per week, which is a pretty steep requirement.
So just to be clear, if these folks aren't working and now they're going to be forced to work, but if they're not working because they can't find work, how does that work? It just feels like a little a difficult issue to get past.
Yeah, there's some interesting research on who actually falls into this category. And as best we know, it's basically people who are kind of in and out of work. So you'll have a job for 6 months and then you'll be out of work for a month or two and you'll go on SNAP. As part of the 1996 welfare reform, the Clinton administration added this requirement that you can only be on SNAP for 3 months out of every 3 years if you're unemployed. And so that is the rule that this is based off. Now, there's been a waiver system in place for a very long time that kind of effectively makes the rule non-existent in many areas with high unemployment.
And yeah, because if you can't find a job in those 3 months, then what do you do?
Right, exactly. And a lot of states have work training programs that you can participate in to meet the requirement, and some will allow you to volunteer, but you're right.
So what was the rationale for these cuts, from at least from the perspective of President Trump and GOP Republican Party?
So on a press call yesterday, the rhetoric was very much about how SNAP is designed to bridge a gap between employment. And there were definitely some echoes of the welfare queen rhetoric that we heard back in the 1980s. There was a lot of talk about people getting used to the program and depending on it and staying on it for long term. Now, I should be clear, the data does not support that rhetoric, but that is what the administration is continuing to say.
So what does the data that you have say?
Again, it mostly shows that people are on for a few months between jobs and that it's a program that's designed to be flexible for that exact reason. And most people who are going to be subject to these new work requirements are in pretty deep poverty, according to the most recent analysis that we've gotten.
Let's talk a little bit about that. You mentioned welfare queen rhetoric, and that's a term, that's a really loaded term that came from welfare reform, quote unquote, under the Clinton administration in the 90s. Often when we talk about belt tightening around entitlements, Claire, it's often framed either overtly or covertly as something that only affects communities of color. But the demographic breakdown, as far as I understand, for SNAP recipients, 40% of SNAP recipients are white, a quarter are black, almost 11% are Hispanic, 2.4% are Asian, and 1% are Native American. So what does that tell us about the recipients? Are poor white voters going to be swayed by Trump's decision on this? Does this hurt that community?
I have no idea how people will vote, but there is increasing evidence that SNAP is moving more toward rural areas. So you're absolutely right. I think the stereotype that it's mostly communities of color in cities is very much alive and well. But for the past decade or two, the benefit recipients have been kind of moving outward. And I want to say in 2016 or 17, for the first time, there were more SNAP beneficiaries in rural areas than in urban areas.
Why food stamps? Why go after this particular entitlement? It just feels, and using entitlement because that's the political language that's used, but we don't go after the farm bill the way we do and the farm bill subsidies like this. So why this, Claire?
It's been a politically fraught program since day one. I think it's the closest thing we have as a country to a universal basic income. It's cash in people's pockets, which for whatever reason, I think causes it to come under the microscope more often. You know, entitlements like Medicare, it's seen as much more evil to go after that because SNAP is essentially just money. And I will say that's why it works. It's been shown that putting money in people's pockets to spend on groceries really does help lift people out of poverty, but it's also vulnerable because it's seen as a check.
A check that's supposed to be used for food, though.
Correct.
So the proposal for these cuts went through a public comment period where members of the public, and this is standard, were allowed to weigh in on these cuts. Claire, do we know what the public sentiment was on these cuts to food stamps?
We do. I think there were more than 140,000 public comments submitted for this particular rule.
So people did participate in the public comment period.
Oh, absolutely. And most were against it. And there's a lot of political interest, you know, in the inbox. We got lots and lots of congresspeople making statements. Again, I will say this is one of three changes to SNAP. There's actually a much bigger one rolling down the line. And so this issue is by far not being put to bed as this rule rolls out. The next one coming down the line will impact even more people. It's estimated to strip benefits from more than 3 million people, and it will also take away free school lunch from about 500,000 kids.
And free school lunch is something that's also been debated because there are kids around the country who can't afford to eat lunch right now.
Right. It's kind of indirect. It will essentially make them not automatically eligible, so families will have to go through a paperwork process to get that benefit.
Free school lunches could be affected. What else could be affected? More Americans?
More Americans, absolutely. And even under this rule, it's an estimated 688,000 people will lose benefits, but there will be an additional couple million people who will be newly subject to these work requirements, these 20 hours a week work requirements.
You looked into expanded work requirements in Wisconsin and how they actually have played out there. What did you find?
So Wisconsin expanded work requirements back in 2015, so they're a few years further along than the rest of the country. It's often seen as kind of a bellwether state, particularly in the past when it had a very Republican-controlled government. A lot of eligibility requirements were pushed through. And so what happened in Wisconsin was that Governor Scott Walker expanded work requirements, and then they basically didn't tell people on SNAP that this program was coming into existence. And so they contracted with an outside agency called, it used to be called ResCare, it's now called BrightSpring Health, that manages foster care. It manages a bunch of, you know, kind of government contracts. ResCare came in to manage this work requirement system. And I talked to some former caseworkers with ResCare, and they said, Wisconsin didn't even tell people that we were coming in. And so they were cold calling SNAP recipients and telling them that they're newly subject to work requirements, and people didn't believe them. One caseworker I talked to said that people thought he was a scammer because this is a private company calling you and telling you that they are now in charge of your food benefits.
That's interesting. So again, we talk a lot about public-private partnerships here on the show. Is it that private companies are now starting to take over the administration of these food stamps and benefits?
These work training programs, yes. And ResCare actually costs taxpayers twice as much per participant as just paying out SNAP benefits. It also cost about twice as much what the government estimated. And so it's not a cheaper way of managing these programs. It's just, I don't think the state of Wisconsin had the capacity to manage work requirements in-house.
That's one of the things I was going to ask you about, because a big talking point when it comes to cutting SNAP benefits is that it's supposed to save money. Did that happen in Wisconsin?
Not as far as I could tell. ResCare, again, cost the taxpayers twice what SNAP benefits cost. And that's in addition to SNAP benefits, because you're doing this to stay in the program. And it only found jobs for about one third of participants. And that's kind of the best case scenario. That's assuming everyone who got a job kept their job. So there's not a whole lot of evidence that it's working. Former Governor Scott Walker vetoed a provision that would require more oversight for the program. So data on the success is a little bit scarce. But basically what happened is a fraction of the people who are subject to work requirements actually signed up for the program. So lots of people just automatically lost benefits. A lot of that was because of the problems with the rollout. And then of the people who enrolled in the program, many lost benefits because caseworkers with 40 cases would just submit the paperwork wrong. One of the big problems that people talked to me about was, if you don't have transportation, you can ride on the bus for an hour and a half to submit the receipt that said you went to the library and did a job training course for 5 hours a week. And so this 20-hour requirement, there's this initial layer of administrative red tape where you're having to show up in person to show that you did this work that then sometimes get logged and sometimes doesn't. And so my understanding, based on talking to former caseworkers, was that it was actually quite cumbersome to keep up with the requirements.
President Trump tends to favor using executive orders to get a lot of his policy initiatives that struggle to make it through Congress achieved. That was what he did here. Does this mean that a future presidential administration could undo these requirements?
Yes, I think so. As we've seen, making a rule takes a really long time. This was actually first proposed the same day President Trump signed a farm bill, because it was seen as a consolation prize for House Republicans who actually tried to pass via Congress much stricter work requirements that failed because House Democrats and even some House Republicans did not get on board. And so this was kind of an executive solution to get at the same issue.
And we should also mention that, I mean, farmers have gotten lots of subsidies from American taxpayers. Why is that not considered something that has to be examined in the face of when we're talking about the broader food issues here in the United States?
I don't know. The Farm Bill is this really interesting piece of legislation that has always tied food aid to farm subsidies. And it's basically, they tied them together to get urban voters to support the farm subsidies that generally pass as part of the bill. And so rural legislatures and urban legislatures have always had to work together to pass this bill. And so I think farm subsidies are less examined because they're a lot more invisible. But there was reporting from Bloomberg yesterday that showed six studies agreed that farm subsidies as part of the trade war actually overpaid soy growers this year. And so they got in government aid more than they ever would have made if they had just grown soybeans and sold them at the market rate in the absence of a trade war.
Claire Brown is a staff reporter at the New Food Economy. Claire, thanks so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
According to the Sentencing Project, nearly 10% of citizens in Mississippi have been disenfranchised of their right to vote. That's more than triple the national rate. The state is estimated to have the largest population of people who lost the right to vote in the country. A big reason for why this number is so high is the subject of a new federal court case. Under Mississippi's Constitution, there are 22 felonies spelled out. Once anyone in the state is convicted of one of those crimes, they lose their right to vote permanently. On Tuesday, judges at the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans heard arguments about the constitutionality of this practice, and it's part of a class action lawsuit brought on behalf of six people who have been convicted and lost their right to vote. Dennis Hopkins is one of the six people who brought this case to court as a class action. Hopkins completed his sentence of grand larceny 16 years ago and still can't vote. Here he is talking to the Southern Poverty Law Center.
These people that's going to judge me, they should walk in my shoes. Shame on them for judging me, because you know what? I'm the one that paid my debt to society. and I'm the one that pays my taxes. I have a right to do that, but I don't have a right to vote. And it's not where I came from, it's how I finish.
Paloma Wu is the senior supervising attorney for the Southern Poverty Law Center, who's one of the representatives for Hopkins and the other plaintiffs, and she joins us now. Paloma, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having us.
So Mississippi has a long list of crimes spelled out in its constitution. Once you're convicted of one of these crimes, essentially there's no way to get your voting rights restored. Is that right?
Effectively, there is no way. We have sort of a sham way, which is part of our lawsuit. Only 18 people got their right restored between 2013 and 2018. You have to get an individual legislator to pass a bill in your name by 2/3 of both houses of the Mississippi legislature in order to get your right to vote back. It's not a meaningful system. There are no standards that's completely discretionary, and it's simply disproportionately impacts Black voters, but it impacts all Mississippians who've lost their right to vote. 50,000 Mississippians were convicted of disqualifying crimes in the last about 24, 25 years, and most of them have completed their sentence, including probation and parole. We represent all those people, about 30,000 in this class action.
On Tuesday, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which you work for, argued that this practice is unconstitutional. You mentioned there are three states across the country that do this. What is the argument there? Explain how this is unconstitutional.
We, along with our co-counsel at Simpson Thatcher, brought this case on behalf of folks in Mississippi. We've argued that Mississippi's lifetime voting ban that's automatic as to all felonies and its sort of meaningless scheme of getting your right to vote back violates the Eighth Amendment. It's essentially cruel and unusual punishment. Over 40 states, in the United States have no such lifetime voting ban for individuals who've completed their sentences. There are a wide range of studies that show that the inability of people to get their right to vote back once they've returned is devastating. It actually increases recidivism rates when you don't give people the right to vote back. It makes it difficult for them to reintegrate back into their communities. These people are paying taxes for decades. They're raising families. Their kids are in schools. They can't elect the school boards. They can't elect the judges that adjudicate the guilt and innocence of the people around them and those they love. These are people. We need their voices to be heard. And having these draconian disenfranchisement laws that are rooted in post-Civil War Mississippi, these schemes violate Equal Protection Clause. They disqualify Black voters at a rate of 2-1 in Mississippi. And that is doing what it was meant to do. So these provisions were adopted with the express purpose to secure the state of Mississippi for white people and consolidate political power at a time when freed Black people and their descendants were actually gaining political power. So this is part of a longer fight, but it's a very, very critical point for us in Mississippi.
Paloma, let's talk a little bit about, we know that there are racial disparities in the criminal justice system. How much does that play into what's happening here in Mississippi?
You know, tying the right to vote, excluding people from the franchise for things like involvement in the criminal justice system or the amount of money that you have, I mean, this is the rule one for the Mississippi plan, which, you know, came after the, you know, Civil War. First, Mississippians who were white, who were trying to keep political power to themselves, they carried elections by fraud and violence. When Black Americans started organizing, then they, then they called constitutional conventions, Mississippi being one of the first, for the purpose of creating essentially, intertwined voter eligibility requirements that would result in sweeping lifelong disenfranchisement of African Americans while minimizing disenfranchisement of white people. And so, this is historically, unrebutted information about where these laws came from. So when we get them in Mississippi, we exported them across the country along with the Great Migration. We took them everywhere, and people across the country have been dismantling them because they see these laws for what they are.
Let me ask you about that, because across the country, we just mentioned Florida, and last November, we've covered this on the show, Floridians voted to reinstate voting rights for people who've been convicted and completed probation and parole, excluding those convicted of murder and sexual offense. And we know that was a big political fight. Legislators wanted to bring back the ability to still prevent people from voting by having them pay off their debts related to their crimes. Overall, Paloma, is the issue of reenfranchisement gaining national momentum?
Absolutely. And that's part of one of the claims the way we brought in our case over the last 50 years. You know, it's flip-flopped the proportion of states that used to have lifetime voting bans and now, you know, over 40 where there's no lifetime voting ban for individuals who have completed their sentence. You know, when Florida, nearly two-thirds of Floridian, you know, voting citizens voted to reenfranchise returning citizens. It's the largest expansion of voting rights since the Voting Rights Act passed in Louisiana. Returning citizens, they are organized in order to get returning citizens their right to vote back. And, you know, Southern Poverty Law Center, we know racial pretext. We've been helping to go after these things. And we filed a lawsuit in, you know, Florida banning what we call the modern day poll tax. Modern day poll tax, when you tie the franchise to involvement in the criminal justice system, when you tie the franchise, how much money do you have? Do you happen to owe anybody money? You know, these are old games. These are old ploys. So the fact that they're coming back is incredibly disturbing. So just at a time when we find the tide changing, that there's no lifetime voting ban. I mean, this is one of the fundamental arguments in our cruel and unusual punishment claim, is the times have changed. So that is, you know, no lifetime voting ban. Times have changed, but now we're bringing back the poll tax in Florida. So, you know, this is something that we have to remain vigilant about, even though we're at a time when it is getting more attention and people are starting to try to give people the right to vote back, which they did have briefly after the Civil War, but before these big Reconstruction constitutions.
Paloma, is there any federal legislation that could change voting rights laws nationally, or is this still going to be a state by state issue?
You know, we believe every state has to be focusing on this within each state. But there, you know, the federal government, you know, could act to make clear that, you know, your socioeconomic status and, you know, your race shouldn't be impacting your right to the franchise.
Paloma Wu is a senior supervising attorney for the Southern Poverty Law Center, one of the representatives for the plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit against Mississippi's felony voting rights laws. Paloma, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It is with deep regret, but also with deep gratitude, that I am suspending our campaign today.
Senator Kamala Harris ended her campaign for president this week, citing a budgetary shortfall. The Democratic National Committee started with the most diverse slate of presidential candidates in history, but it's now looking at a dwindling roster for 2020. And Harris was the only candidate of color who had qualified to be on stage for the Democratic debate in December. And while other candidates have until December 12th to qualify, so far all of the candidates on that stage will be white. Senator Cory Booker told BuzzFeed's AM to DM that he was disappointed at the lack of diversity.
You just sort of like don't understand how we've gotten to a point now that there's more billionaires in the 2020 race than there are black people.
But Harris's departure from the field also follows political obituaries in the New York Times and the Washington Post detailing just how her campaign unraveled. Fellow candidate Julian Castro criticized the media's treatment of Harris and her campaign in a video tweeted out by his campaign staff.
In the last few days, to see articles out of Politico, the New York Times, Washington Post, that it basically trashed her campaign and focused on just one small part of it, and I think held her to a different standard, a double standard, has been grossly unfair and unfortunate.
We're going to examine that double standard when it comes to how the media has covered Democrats in the 2020 race for president. For the most part, candidates of color like Booker, Harris, Castro, and Andrew Yang have not enjoyed the same type of fawning media coverage as their white male counterparts. For more on this, I'm joined by Nidhi Prakash, politics reporter at BuzzFeed. Nidhi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Kamala Harris. She had a great first debate. Slowly, we began to see her star power sort of dwindle away. How much of that do you think was due to problems within the campaign, which we should say were very real? And how much of that do you think was part of the media's portrayal of her?
I think there are so many factors that play into that. And certainly some of the reporting that's come out in the last couple of weeks about the troubles within her campaign, as you say, that is very real. There is also a real thing that we need to examine about the role that we're playing as reporters, you know, in a mostly white press corps as well, in the amount of attention and the kind of attention that we've been giving to candidates of color and specifically women of color.
When you say we as reporters of color need to pay attention, what do you mean? Are you all saying that you're not doing enough? Or is it that the largely white press corps that follows politics is not focusing on the right things?
I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. I mean, it's pushing to make sure that we are covering candidates of color as much as we can, just in terms of giving them the same kind of attention that other candidates are getting. But it's also about asking different questions. And something that sort of comes to mind for me when I think about that is Julian Castro being asked kind of pretty early on, you know, why don't you speak fluent Spanish? Which, you know, is a pretty sort of, I would say, embarrassingly kind of superficial question to ask a third generation immigrant. But, you know, I think like given the press corps is mostly white and there weren't people in that room to sort of say, well, there is an explanation. Let's talk about this in a more nuanced way. That is the conversation that we ended up having.
You have followed Julian Castro's campaign very closely. There was another moment, I think, that stood out in terms of the coverage of Castro, specifically during the second debate when he took on Joe Biden.
They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
To buy in. If she qualifies,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
And there were people who said, you know what, Joe Biden is supposed to go up against President Trump, who does not pull any punches. Julian Castro kind of took a punch there. Was he treated unfairly? Is that part of the overall media tone that you're noticing with Castro in particular?
So obviously, there is a tendency to kind of cast people of color as being, you know, that whole idea of like angry people of color, as opposed to sort of like just having a reasonable debate. And I think there might have been a little bit about that, definitely, in the way that that moment was covered with Castro.
Talk a little bit about gender in all of this. Hillary Clinton, in her campaign, obviously against Donald Trump, there were many gendered critiques of how she was covered versus Donald Trump was covered. But I think Elizabeth Warren, in some instances, has also gotten, you know, maybe not so favorable media coverage. Some have called her too professorial, for example. What role does gender play in the coverage here of these candidates?
Some of those ideas of likability that sort of mysteriously only really matter for women candidates have never really gone away. That's something that I think maybe in this election cycle is sort of being expressed through this idea of electability as well. That's something that Harris brought up. And I think it's clear that part of that narrative is sort of questioning whether a woman or a person of color can be competitive against Trump. So it's sort of manifesting in different ways. But I think certainly with Elizabeth Warren, that's something that I've heard from voters as well in Iowa and New Hampshire, that they like her, but she's too stern or too professorial and isn't electable.
A lot of what we hear when it comes to candidates of color, and we should recall that Julian Castro, who's now running for president himself, was just in the last presidential election with Hillary Clinton and President Trump, was considered a front runner for Clinton's vice president. That often happens with candidates of color. Just yesterday, Joe Biden was asked if he would consider Kamala Harris a vice presidential candidate. How does that narrative around the media favoring a white presidential candidate over women and minorities, you think, come to play into this?
I mean, I think that that is the kind of underlying assumption or bias that we have to be very conscious of and try and sort of, you know, not fall into, right? I mean, particularly, I think, white reporters and white editors. And I think that's the other important point, is that it's not just the reporters on the ground, but it's also like the media structure that we have, where editors and managers are, you know, even more significantly white. That's, you know, we have definitely a lack of diversity on that level as well. Understanding that that historically has been the default, and that has been, you know, for many reasons, the kind of assumption that a white person is going to be the person in that position of power. It's really important, I think, to acknowledge that and to be able to kind of think through that consciously about how we're then seeing candidates of color.
Going forward, we now have fewer diverse candidates on the roster than we did before. None of them have really gotten the amount of support, at least in the early polls, that the frontrunners have gotten. You've been covering this campaign cycle. You're now on the road with Joe Biden. How can the media do better when covering these candidates and just the overall narratives?
the starting point, and this should be true really of all reporting, is to start from a point of examining the assumptions that have been made in previous campaigns historically, and even just personally and individually as reporters and editors. I think that that is, you know, fundamentally the best place to start from. That gives us the best possibility of covering candidates of color fairly, which, I mean, I think, to be clear, that I don't think we have to be uncritical to be fair to candidates of color and to women, but I think that it's important to sort of understand that historical context and some of the assumptions we might be making.
Nidhi Prakash is a politics reporter at BuzzFeed. Nidhi, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.